Welcome back to the Mindful Hunter podcast. I'm your host as always, Jay Nickel. Q&A episode this week. Tons of good questions. As a reminder, if you belong to the Mind for Reviews platform, your questions get priority. So we'll go through those first, and then we will hit up the Instagram questions. A little bit of house cleaning. The raffle for the Swarovski NL Pure 10x42s finished up last week. So congratulations, Murray, on winning those. And congratulations to Chris on winning the back skeletonized processing knife for the monthly lifetime membership draw from Mindful Reviews. Quick reminder, if you like what I do, you like the reviews, you want to see more of the reviews, the best way to support is to go join the Mindful Reviews platform. So mindful-reviews.com. It is a subscription-based membership platform. You can participate in the reviews, request reviews, buy raffle tickets for the raffles after the reviews are done. And if you're a lifetime member, you get entered into a monthly draw for a kick-ass piece of hunting gear. Any other questions about that, let me know. So, without further ado, let's dig into this week's questions. It is currently 4:30 in the morning on Thursday, and I'm heading scouting today, and I'm getting ready to leave for sheep in how many days? Let's open up the calendar and have a quick peek. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. I leave for sheep in 13 days. So, I have a lot to do, and this was the only time I had to do this week, so here we are. All right, let's dive in. Richard G says, I have more experience in precision shooting than I do in hunting. So some of the things hunters prioritize surprise me. Number one, why do hunters choose ultralight rifles instead of cutting weight from something else? In my opinion, keeping a little more weight on the rifle improves stability and makes long-range shots more doable for shooters of most skill levels. There's a part number two, but let's deal with number one first. I think you're right. I think you raise a very interesting point. I want to add some context though. Most people who are cutting weight from rifles have already cut all the weight from somewhere else. Like there is, by the time I get to my rifle, there are very few places left. I'll say there are no places left for me to cut weight. I'm running an ultralight sleeping pad. I'm running a down quilt. I'm running, let me look through my kind of gear list here. Like everything in my, you know, I remember when I was running a Kafaru pack, I originally bought their tactical frame and I spent, I don't even know what it was, $700 to switch to the duplex light because it was going to save me 1 pound. So that was there. I've cut out inflatable pillows this year in order to shave weight. Tripod, pan head. I literally have the lightest tripod and pan head on the market. So part one of your question, why don't they cut weight somewhere else, is that most likely they already have cut weight everywhere else. And I'll add some context. I run a heavier bow because I shoot much better with a heavier bow. And it's worth it for me to put, I don't know, maybe it's 3/4 of a pound of additional stabilizing weights on my bow. Now, it is a carbon bow, but the funny thing is the carbon Ultra RX7 really isn't that much lighter than the Ventum. I just liked the Ultra more, but I do add weight to my bow because it shoots better for me. Something else you mentioned here is you talk about shooting long range. I also think that's not something all hunters are interested in. Like my setup is built to shoot sub 600 yards, and I don't think it is unreasonable to shoot a sub 8 pound rifle under 600 yards. I think if you start getting, I don't even know how you would get significantly lighter than that, but if you do get significantly lighter than that, or you do start shooting farther than that, I think you are looking for trouble, or you're certainly not building an optimum setup. But the crux of your question is that a heavier rifle creates a better shooting platform. And I think it's a great point. And I think it's something more people, including myself, should take into account. I'll even go a little bit further and say your scope. You know, you can cut a lot of weight and be running a 16-ounce scope, but by going up just 3 or 4 ounces, you could get a scope with a lot more features, a lot better glass. And so that might be 3 or 4 ounces worth carrying. I know for me, I have a titanium action in my Fierce CT Rival. And some people don't like titanium actions. And this isn't even about shooting accuracy. This is about the kind of shooting experience. They feel kind of sticky. And so maybe adding a few ounces and going back to a steel action is something that you want to do. Here's the problem. I don't think a lot of people have the ability to shoot from multiple platforms. I think if you could sit somebody down and say, here's a 7.5 pound setup, go shoot some targets at 700-800 yards. Cause I think that's, you know, probably within the skill level, laying prone with a good setup of most hunters. And now here, take a 9 pound setup and go do the same thing. I think if you could actually feel the difference, I know I haven't, I've shot very few rifles, in my hunting life, less than 5. So I don't have a whole lot to go on. So that might be another reason, is just lack of ability to shoot multiple platforms. We try and exert control where we can. And I think shaving ounces on your rifle is something you can do. But there are lots of experienced guys. Like, look at Brady Miller. That dude carries a tank of a rifle and does not give a shit. And he kills all kinds of stuff. And he likes a heavy bow and he likes a heavy rifle. Okay. Number 2, why are grid style mil reticles not standard in the bottom portion of all hunting scopes? Obviously, solo hunters would not benefit, but follow-up corrections are so much easier when the shooter and spotter are able to talk in specific measurements. I would buy a Swaro in a heartbeat, but they will never put a reticle in the scope, and that's a deal breaker for me, so I will get a Hensoldt. Thanks, Jay. Great question. I got to be honest. Little bit above my pay grade. I don't think I don't think most hunters are super technically proficient. I know hunters who don't even know the difference between MRAD and MOA. They just go in and buy whatever scope is recommended to them. So I think that's probably more of a lack of technical expertise. Great question. And something I'd like some more information on. Maybe this is a good question if people want to hit me up. You know, what type of reticles are you running in your scope? I personally run a Leupold 3-15x44 VX5 HD, and it has a fire dot duplex scope. So I think I definitely fall into the camp of people that you're specifically talking about. And what was attractive to me about that scope was the simplicity. So when I built my rifle, I wanted a rifle with turrets where I would be dialing in my distance. I did not want to be using marks on my scope to estimate distances. My last rifle did that, and I just didn't enjoy it. And I know the community this is a polarizing topic, and the community is kind of split, especially for people who are on the intermediate rifle skill level, like myself. I know guides that hate people who have dialing turrets because it's just another variable and another opportunity for a mistake. But I really like it. And so I wanted the simplest, cleanest sight picture possible. I like the little illuminated red dot. I like that there's not a lot of junk in my way. It reminds me a lot of my archery target. It's clean. I just need to put the bright dot in the kill zone and pull the trigger. And if I'm off, I can dial appropriately and take another shot. Do you think that there's an argument to be able to rectify a follow-up shot and based on markings in your scope is much faster and more efficient than having a simpler sight picture? So Yeah, I'd love to hear from you guys. What kind of reticles are you running? And what are some of the benefits that you have seen? And what are some of the things that you don't like? All right, up next, Vance asks, been wanting to record my hunts for a few years and just haven't done it yet. I find I always end up just focusing on the hunt and afterwards thinking how badass it would have been on video. But I am going to do it this year. Just looking for tips on what you found worked well when you were starting out. I'm mostly solo. I just enjoy sharing my hunting stories and photos and want to step up sharing videos. Thanks, Jay. This got me thinking. I know a lot of dudes have run like big expensive courses and whatnot on filming hunts. And I think that's fine. I think it is a very complicated topic, but I'm wondering, much like my meal planning PDF, would you guys find it beneficial if I put together like a 6 to 7 page PDF? It would be a free download where I could break down the basics of filming and photography and, you know, specifically related to the backcountry and how you would create a backcountry filming setup and, you know, just how you would go about filming and editing a hunt. Let me know if that's something that you would think is valuable. And maybe when we hit the next off season, I'll try and create that, because I do get a lot of questions about this. And it's a very in-depth topic, but I don't think you have to make it overly complicated. Here's what I'm going to say. This is what I believe are the bare essentials is just an iPhone. You can get shit done. But let's say you want to go to the next level. What do I think is like, you know, the minimum you can get away with where you're still going to be able to tell the story? Because that's the compromise. That's the struggle you're facing as a backcountry hunter / filmer. To tell a better story requires more equipment, because it gives you different looks. It gives you the ability to tell the story from different angles and different ways to keep it more interesting. But the more gear you carry, the more it slows you down, because you're switching from different pieces of gear and the heavier it gets. So it's always like, what's the minimum I can get away with while still telling this story in an authentic manner? So here's what I think the bare minimum is: an action camera. I think you should buy the latest GoPro Hero Black. It's bomb-proof. It's time tested. It's supported by the community. There's lots of like cool, you know, little extras you can get for it. And with this, you need some way to mount it on an attachable tripod, like some kind of device that you can clip to a tree, wrap around stuff. And I use a Joby GorillaPod. You can get knockoffs on Amazon. Don't do it. The little balls on the legs pop off all the time. Just get the good one. It's the mini one. It's like maybe 12 inches long. Joby GorillaPod. And then you need some way to attach it to your body. I like the head strap, because you need to be able to record stuff hands-free. This is where you're going to get your walking around footage. If you're solo, this is how you're going to get your kill shot. And finally, I like some way to attach it to my trekking pole, because that gives me the ability to have a real quick, taller tripod. I can slam it in the dirt and do a time lapse of setting up my tent really easy. Also, it gives you an interesting look for walking around footage. So when you're recording, when you're holding the camera up or you're using it on your head, you get this cool first person angle. But one of the things you realize in filmmaking is that if you're using the same angles over and over and over again, it becomes a very monotonous viewing experience. So one of the tricks is you need to switch up the angles in the shots. Close angle, medium angle, wide angle. Is the participant or the subject in the shot? Are they out of the shot? Whose perspective is it from? And if you can be switching this up all the time, it gives the film a greater sense of movement and interest. And so I like having it. I buy a mountain biking handlebar GoPro mount, and I put this on the end of my tripod just below, or sorry, on the end of my trekking pole, just underneath the handle. And then when I want to take some shots, I put the GoPro on the end of the trekking pole. I hold the trekking pole by the pointy end and I hold it out at arm's length. And I get this cool shot of like, I'm in the shot, the mountains are behind me, or I'm going up whatever, or there's a creek, or I'm crossing something. And so there's number one thing: you need an action camera. You need a head strap, you need a Joby Gorilla Pod, and you need a mounting device for your trekking pole. That's all. The camera is maybe $400 or $500, but all those attachments are like $50 altogether. It's not particularly expensive. Okay, and there's your action footage. That's what's going to get. There's your time lapses. There's your walking around footage, your kill shots, all kinds of stuff. Now you need some way to tell the story. I'm going to use the term DSLR, but the cameras I'm going to recommend are actually mirrorless. I'm not going to get into the difference. When I say DSLR or mirrorless, you're thinking like an actual camera, a camera with interchangeable lenses, a camera where you can manually control the shutter, the aperture, and the ISO. I won't go into all of those right now. There's lots of YouTube tutorials that you can. But if you want to create a film with like a high production value or an artistic sense, like something, iPhones shoot pretty flat. The newer ones with the cinematic footage, they can do a lot more, but most of your point and shoot cameras where you can't manually control all that stuff, shoot a pretty flat frame. When you can have depth to your frame and you can have bokeh and you can have the fuzzy backgrounds and the sharp portraits, this gives your film a sense of depth and quality. And here's the deal. If you care about production, people will care about your film. Like that, like production quality is something that's mattered for me ever since I started. I would recommend, there's a new Sony A6700, but apparently there's some overheating issues with the pre-production models. So I'm going to hold off on recommending that camera right now, but like an A63 or 6500, it's a 3/4 frame camera. I would spend money on lenses, not spend money on the camera, because you can always upgrade the camera body later. And if you go from a 3/4 to a full frame camera, the lenses are all going to work. The focal lengths change because you know, they get, I won't get into why the focal lengths, because this is a deeper conversation, but start off with something in that Sony A6 line. It's a great camera. The Sony cameras are the best. I know there's some Canon guys here, but Sony cameras are way lighter. I will have, like, there's an argument Sony, Canon, and there's lots of great Canon cameras, but it's very clear that for backcountry purposes, Sony is the way to go. They're lighter, they're very durable. I've had very good luck with mine. I personally shoot a Sony A1. And before that, if you wanted to take a step up from the Sony A6 line, I would look at the Sony AS3 or AS4. If you can get a used AS3, that is a powerhouse of a full frame camera. You can do 120p in 4K. You can, and it's a full frame. It's all kinds of stuff. Now for lenses, I've gone back and forth on this. I've shot prime lenses, which are lenses that don't zoom in and zoom out. I've thought about carrying multiple lenses. At the end of the day, 99% of the time when I'm solo hunting, I take a single 24 to 70 mil lens. If you don't have a ton of cash, you buy a Sigma 24 to 70 mil lens. It's probably going to set you back about $1,600. You can probably find a used one for somewhere in the neighborhood of $800. If you do have money, you get the Sony G Master second generation 24 to 70. That's going to run you about $3,000. That's my money lens. That's what I run 99% of the time. The two other lenses I have are a 14 mil wide and a 35 mil kind of do it all lens. I use that primarily when I'm shooting at home in the studio, because it has a faster aperture, so I can get more depth of field and capture more light in my studio to give it like a nicer kind of quality of image. But here's the deal. None of that really matters. You need an action camera and you need a storytelling camera. Do whatever you want for the storytelling camera. Budget guys, I would go in the Sony A6 lines. Next step up would be the Sony A3 line. Get a 24 to 70 lens or some kind of zoom kit lens. There are going to be lots of cameras that come with an 18 to 55 with the camera. That's totally fine. Here's why you need that. In order to shoot vlog footage firsthand, you need a lens that goes down to at least 24 mil. That would be the lowest I would go. If it goes all the way to 16 mil, great. The reason for this is the limit of holding the camera out at your hand. If you're holding a 35 mil lens out with your hand, your head is going to be the whole screen and you're going to be chopping off bits of your head if your hand moves around a little bit. If you get down to 24 and 16, you can hold it out at arm's length. You get a nice picture behind you. Your head is appropriately sized in the frame. It just looks way better. And the reason I found you need a little bit of zoom is like, listen, it would be great to be carrying around a 200 mil lens and get wildlife photography shots. And if you want to do that, go ahead. But those lenses cost a fortune and they're heavy as shit. So if you're on a partner hunt or if you're doing scouting and photography is your thing, yes, obviously, if you're Stephen Drake or Adam Foss, you're carrying a long zoom lens, 100%. But for us, just like solo storytellers, just having some ability to zoom in, you know, to reach out to 70 mil. That way, if you do see a deer 150 yards away or something interesting is happening with your hunting partner 150 or 200 yards away, you do have the ability to close the distance. Also, for landscape photography, when you use a longer focal length, it compresses the items that are in view. So Foss is famous for this. You know how Foss gets those shots where there's a dude walking along a ridgeline and then there's a mountain behind the dude and the mountain looks gargantuan. Like you're just like, it's very awe-inspiring. Okay, the way you do that is you back up from your subject and you use a long focal length. And the long focal length brings the subject and the background closer together. So that's what makes the background look so much bigger compared to the subject. It doesn't look that impressive in real life, but using a long focal length does this. And so being able to shoot out to 70 mil gives you, again, I was talking earlier about different looks. It enables you to add different looks to your film without adding a significant amount of weight. So that's my recommendation. And then you need some way to attach that device to your body, because here's the deal. If your camera is not accessible, you're not going to shoot. You don't carry it in your pack. Don't worry about beating it up. It's part of the deal. If you're going to film backcountry hunts, you're going to beat the shit out of your gear. So I like the Cotton Carrier system. I'm thinking about switching to the Peak Design system because it's ArcaSwiss compatible, and that would then allow me to go back to just one mount on the bottom of my camera instead of two. But I firmly believe that you need some way to mount the camera to the shoulder strap of your backpack, because when shit happens, you need to pop it off and shoot immediately. And so I wear the GoPro on my head or the trekking pole at all times, and I wear my main camera on my shoulder strap at all times. I even have a little plastic rain cover that you can buy for like $2 on Amazon that goes over it. So in light rain, now when it starts raining heavy, I put away the storytelling camera, or it starts snowing heavy, I have a bag and I put it in my backpack because I don't want to worry about it. And I've shot entire films. If you go look at my first goat hunting film, Maximum Effort, I actually thought I fried my camera on the way in the snow, so I just left it packed. That entire film, except for about 15 seconds of footage in the intro, is shot on two GoPros. And like, I don't mean to toot my own horn, but that is a badass looking film. Now, listen, we can have a whole other conversation about editing and color grading and color correction and LUTs and how to achieve a filmic look and sweetening audio. Like, these are all topics that I've spent 20 years because of the work I'm doing now and the work that I used to do learning about. And I'm more than happy to share all of that. But if we're just saying like, how do you get out there and capture some footage so you can share your memories? Action camera, couple accessories, storytelling camera, decent little mid-range zoom lens, attach both of them to your body and just shoot all the time. Because here's what's going to happen. If you only shoot the events that are interesting, you have no way to tie them together. And this was a learning experience for me. On my first few hunts, I would get home. And if I haven't gone hunting in a while, like, I'm actually glad I shot the scouting vlogs because I'm warmed up. What normally happens on a sheep hunt is I haven't filmed anything since like February. And so I kind of forget all the little things that I do to make my system work. And then I get home and I'm like, ah, I kind of wish I'd done this or done that. But because I do in the vlogs, I feel like I'm in shooting shape. You need transition footage because you need a way to tie your story together. So if just all of a sudden you're up on top of a hill looking at a sheep, it's like, well, what put you here? How did you get here? Was there a struggle getting here? Was it easy getting here? How long did it take? Where are we in the hunt? You don't want to just... The best advice, filmmaking advice I've ever been given is show them, don't tell them. So instead of getting to the... And listen, I do a lot of telling in my films because you're kind of limited, especially on a solo hunt, but I do my best to use transition footage, like little 5-second clips of me walking, little 5-second clips of me unpacking a bag or setting up a tent, like little B-roll things that you at the time don't really matter. But when you get back to the editing booth, you have these main points in your story and you need to tie those points together to bring the audience just can't show up someplace. It feels uncomfortable and jarring and they don't understand why they're there. You need to give them a sense of context about how they got where they are and why they are where they are. So shoot everything. Shoot some walking around, shoot filling up a water bottle, shoot eating your lunch, shoot a sunset, shoot some time lapse of cool clouds, shoot setting up camp, shoot cleaning your rifle, shoot getting ready at the truck, shoot tying up your boots. I mean, just shoot it all. And then once you get used to what you're doing, you'll understand, you'll be more efficient and you'll be like, okay, I like this kind of stuff. I don't like this kind of stuff. My editing process is way faster these days because 90% of the stuff that I bring back, I end up using. All right. I kind of went deeper into that than I thought I did, but let me know if you want a little primer PDF on shooting in the backcountry. I'll try and put that together in the off season. And B, if you have any more specific questions, please let me know. Unfortunately, people always ask me budget camera questions and it's not my area of expertise. My camera costs about $8,000 because I love this. It's my life. It's what I do. I spend money looking at really high-end camera gear. Go to YouTube. If you want a budget camera, type in best budget camera in YouTube, watch a couple hours of reviews. You're going to get way better information than I can give you. But when it comes to like gear setup and shooting in the backcountry, you got any questions, please let me know. I'm always happy to answer those. All right, Ricardo asks, how long do you find yourself glassing before you move on if you're not seeing anything? And what would change your mind to go against moving locations even if you don't see anything? Not long enough, Ricardo. This is the hallmark of my kind of biggest error as a hunter. And that, you know, it's one of the reasons why I'm trying to hunt with dudes who are older than me that have killed more shit than me this year, because I don't know the answer to your question. And I think, you know, the answer is kind of longer than you think. I don't think there is any perfect answer for this. I think it just comes with experience. And I'm going to say this again because I do think it needs to be reiterated. However long you think is long enough, do it again. You know, I sat in the same location for almost 5 straight days this year on my, no, it was longer than that. It was like 6 days I was in the same location. And it wasn't until the afternoon of day 2 that I started seeing all the goats. Now, maybe the goats were there before that. Maybe they weren't. Maybe they came out. Maybe I just couldn't, I don't know. But I do know that it's the most, as far as like number of goats spotted, it is the most successful goat hunt I've ever been on. And I moved the least. So just take more time. Yeah, I wish I had more, but that's the best I can offer. So, you know what's funny? I've been talking to this guy online for years and I still don't know how to pronounce his name. I'm going to call him Andre. Andre Taramina, I apologize. If I am mispronouncing your first name, please let me know. He says, never used gators before. How waterproof are they? Can you go through deeper water without it leaking in? If so, do you have to just splash through quickly to not give the water time to seep in? 100%. If you just put on gaiters regularly, like they're designed to be put on, you can step quickly, like very quickly, through a creek And as long as you got good high top boots and the laces are done up tight, you will be able to get, you know, maybe a little bit of water in there, but you will be able to stay mostly dry. If your boots are waterproofed and you have good high quality gaiters and the level of the water doesn't go above the gaiter, you can kind of bounce through that crick and you'll be all right. What I see a lot of people, like especially like Alaskan guides doing, is bringing a roll of electrical tape with them. And they will actually tape up the bottom around their ankle and the top around their calf of their gaiter. And they can then withstand a lot more time submerged. You're not going to be standing and fishing in the creek, but you can get through it and stay dry. And I know you just picked up a pair of Peaks, so good luck with those this year and let us know how those go for you. Chris Powell says, given your history within forestry, I'm curious about your experience opinion on how long after a wildfire burns out an area, is that able to recover as habitat? With some of the wildfires starting early in the spring this year in a lot of areas across the West, do you think it's a stretch that they might be starting to see regrowth and animals moving back into an area come fall? I'll share a couple of insights with you that people have shared with me. I think in general, you're looking at 2 to 3 years before a burn becomes like good active habitat again. Obviously, there's exception to that, but in general, 2 to 3 years after a fire, like if you're looking at Onyx and you want to be playing in burns for elk or mule deer and it's 2023, I'd be looking for burns that happened around 2020, even as far back as 2018. Because here's the deal. It also gets to the point where there's a magic window where the regrowth has just started. You can still make good time through the burn, but there's enough vegetation there for the animals to eat, so it draws them in. Then you hit this kind of shitty period where the vegetation gets so thick because there's no canopy closure, so everything just explodes. And the walking through there and being able to spot an animal gets so bad that you don't want to be in there. That's kind of at that, like, depending on the area, this can fluctuate wildly. But let's say at that 10 to 15 year mark, that's when certain areas become unusable, in my opinion. And then you're kind of waiting until it turns back into like mature canopy closed forest before it really becomes nice area. The other thing I'm going to share that a friend shared with me this year is that the productive areas of a burn can be incredibly small. You could have a 5,000 hectare burn and there's only 5 or 10 hectares in there that are holding deer. So don't think that because an area has burned and then there's regrowth, that the whole thing then becomes immediately productive. This guy set up a shit ton of cams and has a lot of data and has found that there are only very small areas within the burns that become productive quickly again. So spend the time to find those areas, walk around, look for sign, set up cameras. But I'd say, yeah, this year, no go. I'd stay out of those. They're going to be dead zones. Walking around there is not only going to be shitty, it's going to be dangerous. The other thing about giving a burn 2 to 3 years is that all those trees that are on the edge of falling over will have experienced enough wind events that they're tipped over. So you're not going to have as many widowmaker potentials. Now, there is an exception to my 2 to 3 year thing, and that is the intensity of the fire. I'm talking about areas that got full-blown nuked, like scorched earth type shit. If it was a light fire, which we do see quite a lot, or a hoppy fire where it's like pockets and it's jumping around and it's left pockets of greened up areas, then you can hunt that at the end of this year 100%. But the only thing that's going to tell you that is putting boots on the ground. Okay, I'm going to try and speed this up because we are taking a bunch of time. Okay, detailed comparison of the new Kawa TSN 66 spotter and the Swaro ATS 65 HD. SNS did a good high level comparison, but I'd like to see how a more detailed comparison by you would turn out. Maybe you could borrow these. So I have already purchased a Kawa 66. I bought it from SNS. Those guys support me a lot, so I support them. And when it's time to buy gear, I buy it from them. I like those guys and I like how they do business. I think okay, I'm 100% going to be comparing this to the ATS-65, but I think it also needs to be compared to the ATX-65. Everybody's kind of in love with the ATS-65 lately, and I get it, but it is not the same optical quality as the ATX. So you need to, the ATS does not have the field flattening lenses, and it does not have the Swarovision vision coatings. Only the ATX and the ATC system do, and that goes for both the S lines as well. So angled and straight, but the X lines and the C lines have field flattening lenses and Swarovisions, visions, and the ATS line and the STS do not. Now, they're lighter scopes, and they have great optical clarity, but just going on the physics, the fluorite crystal in the Kawa is going to have better glass than the Swaro ATS. That's not really even a debatable point. It's just a fact. So what I want to see is the ATX, which has the more comparable glass, how does it hold up against the Kawa 66? Because it doesn't take rocket science for me to tell you that the Kawa 66 is a better scope than the ATS-65, technically speaking. Some people can disagree with that. And your own personal experience, if you like looking through the Swaro ATS better, I mean, have at her. But 100%, you're going to see that up. I have been told that I get the first one that comes in the shop because I was the first guy who laid down cash for the 66. I've been told they're supposed to ship sometime between the 1st and 3rd of August. This was super disappointing to me because I was hoping to take it on my sheep hunt. Now that's not going to happen. It's okay. I still have lots of other hunts this year that I'm going to take it on, but it will delay that review a little bit. Now, how is my investigation of part two of his question, how is my investigation of the $90 Peaks Backcountry Duro and the $20 Sofren headlamp coming along? I'm done my research, finished all my testing this morning, actually took my last measurements, timed my last discharge cycle. That review will be out Monday or Tuesday. I'm not going to get into the results, but I will say they are definitive. I will tell you without a shadow of a doubt, one way or another, which of these two headlamps I would buy and why I'm buying it. All right, my good buddy Jay asked, just wonder if you have considered carrying Narcan to help manage a septic shock situation. And then Andre chips in and says he thought Narcan only worked on opiate overdoses. And Jay chimes back in and says it can raise blood pressure and has been used in septic shock situations. So just to give you a bit of insight, these are the type of conversations that happen on Mindful Review. So if you're looking for dudes who are like super smart and interested in weird, nerdy hunting shit, I'm telling you, Mindful Reviews is the place for you. You're one of us. Now, this again is above my pay grade. So the answer is no, I have not considered carrying Narcan to help manage a septic shock, only because I've never really been that concerned with sepsis or a septic shock situation out there. And maybe that's ignorant on my part, and maybe it's something I need to look into more. And number two, I was not even aware that Narcan was an acceptable remedy for that situation. So maybe some people can chime in and let me know, A, what their experience with Narcan is, and B, what their typical solution for septic shock is, and whether they think it's a common enough experience to prepare for. All right, let's bang out some Instagram questions. I got to wrap this thing up in the next 20 minutes or so. So I'll get through everything I can. Whatever I can't, maybe I'll answer them on Instagram later today. Juby asks, best meal in Europe. I'm going to give two. And there's some other stuff that I'm forgetting, but these two meals really stand out. My third night in France, we went to this restaurant and they had this like garden patio. It was in this like tiny little town, like the countryside of Bordeaux, like storybook shit, man. It was crazy. And for my starter, I had foie gras. And for my main, I had steak tartare. And it was like, when you get either tartare or foie gras in North America, the foie gras is normally like the size of your thumb. Like it's just a little tiny piece. I mean, it's delicious, but it's small. And the tartar will be like the size of a small saucer and maybe like a half an inch thick. Like it's small, you know? The foie gras was at least 3/4 inch thick, and it was a rectangle, probably 3 by 5 inches. Like there was more foie gras on that plate than all the foie gras, and I can't keep saying that word, I feel like a moron, but then all the foie gras I've ever eaten in my life combined. Like, I'm no expert, I've probably only had it half a dozen times, but I look down at this thing, and my wife's friend's husband is sitting across from me, and we both look down at our plates, and we look up, and we're like, this is like $400 worth back home. Like, I don't even know how to eat this much. But it came with this like delicious bread and a couple, you know, a little bit of arugula or something. I forget what else was even on the plate, but it was amazing. Like, melt in your, it came with some type of like jelly, whether I can't remember, maybe it was like a fig jelly or something like that, but holy shit, man. Like, you took that crunchy kind of crostini, you put a little bit of foie gras and then a little bit of that fig jelly. Holy shit, man. And then the steak tartare comes out. And it's like the size of a softball. Like, it was like literally a circle, I don't know, 5 inches in diameter and had to be 1.5-2 inches thick. I was like, is this an entire ribeye chopped up? Like, what am I even looking at? And then, of course, they had a small quail's egg, and you break the quail's egg on top of the steak tartare. For anybody who's listening, steak tartare is just chopped up raw red meat, raw beef. You can have tartare out of anything. You could do elk. I wouldn't do bear because of trichinosis, but you could do elk, you could do deer, you could do goat, you could do sheep, you could do whatever you want. But this was obviously beef tartare. And just the combinations and the size, and it wasn't like over here when you get big portions, it's like kind of crappy food. Over there, it was just, let me tell you this, traveling in Europe for 2 weeks, gave me a whole newfound respect for food, and B, made me somewhat embarrassed of how we treat food in North America. I'll tell a quick story. It was day two, and we went into like just a regular grocery store. It's called a Super U, and we were in France, and we're staying at this chateau that was like far away from everything. So we're like buying our own food and cooking in the kitchen and stuff. And so we went to get food at the grocery store, and you walk in, and like the types of things, like they have charcuterie platters, like wrapped and ready to go, that are like hand cut. And you're just like, you're like, what? And then all the breads and like everything is just like the quality, the tomatoes and the produce, like everything is impeccable and immaculate and cared for and like intentional and thought about. There's no, like, there is obviously like a chip aisle and there's some mass produced stuff for sure. But like the real food was of such high quality and they cared about it so much. So I go to the hot deli counter, you know, here, it's where you'd find like your potato wedges and your chicken wings and your rotisserie chickens, right? So I go to the hot deli counter because I want something for lunch, and I get a couple chicken legs, and and some roast potatoes. And then I look, and there's this like looks like chopped up sausage, like, you know, 2-3 inch sections of sausage in like a marinara. And I'm looking at it, and I go to the woman, I'm like, is that sausage? And she launches into this 5-minute, and I'm in a chain grocery store. She launches into a 5-minute explanation about the island off the coast of someplace where this recipe comes from and how they raise the pigs for this pork. Like, and I was just like, what? It like, I'm like in Savon, and they have like artisanal sausage with like this, some island recipe marinara. So I was just like, holy shit, bought the sausage. Outstanding. Same thing in Italy, like just the quality of the food and the care and attention that goes into the food. Here's something else interesting. I can't eat dairy. Like, dairy fucks me up, which breaks my heart because I am like a fat kid on ice cream. Like, I love ice cream. I could eat a 2-liter tub of ice cream, no problem. But it destroys my guts. Like, the next day I'm a mess. Sometimes I even have problems sleeping. I ate gelato over there every single night. Not only did I feel amazing, I lost weight while I was gone. I ate pasta. I ate pizza. I ate lots of food. I went, you know, I was reasonable. Basically, I would keep things super tight during the day. I would have a late breakfast and then I would have a late lunch, and I would keep both those like on the lighter end of the spectrum. And then once it hit, because we were up until almost midnight every single night. Like, our whole schedule got changed because of how people operate in Europe. Like, everything happens later. So we were eating dinner most nights at 10, getting gelato at 11, and going back to the hotel and going to sleep at 12. And I'm with my 7-year-old kid. She was loving life. But I would be super reasonable until about that like 9, 10 o'clock at night. And then from 9 to 12, I just did whatever I wanted. I'd have a big starter, a big main, a big gelato, and then I'd have some snacks back at the hotel. And I lost 5 pounds while I was gone. Now, we walked, you know, an average day was between 6 to 10 miles, and it was hot as shit. So, I mean, that was a major part of it. But what I was going to say about the gelato, there's something about the quality of ingredients, and maybe because they don't process their eggs the same way we do, and they don't pasteurize some of their milk the same way we do. But I could eat gelato every night, never had a problem with my guts. I ate all the bread, all the pasta, all the pizza, never felt bloated, never felt gassy. Like, yeah, man, the food over there is just different. And I think, you know, taking your family on some type of French or Italian vacation and traveling the countryside and eating at different places. And I think, you know, if you can get the funds for something like that, like, I'm not going to make it out like it's some budget vacation. It's not cheap. But it'll be something my kid's going to remember for the rest of her life. Guaranteed. You know, I'll remember it for the rest of my life. It's the best family vacation we have ever had. And just, I'm not going to go deep into this if you're curious about more, but like, my marriage is like every other marriage. There's ups, there's downs. There's times when we feel closer. There's times when we don't feel as close. I have never had a vacation impact the quality of my marriage like that one did. Like, this was the vacation my wife wanted to go on. It's the vacation we went on, and I made it my mission the entire 2 weeks that she did everything that she wanted to do. And we came home so much closer. And I almost get a little emotional when I start talking about it, but I know we all love hunting and we all love taking trips by ourselves, but like, this really was a bit of a wake up call for me. I need to set aside time to do things, not superficial things for my wife, not take out the garbage, not, you know, not the little, like, you got to do that stuff too, but I'm talking big shit. I'm talking like life-changing shit that she's deeply passionate about. I need to do whatever is required to make those moments happen for her, because when I do that, it just, the intensity and the way we feel about each other, and then in return, how she treats me, it was intense. So yeah, it doesn't have to be an Italy, France vacation. You can do something if you're on a budget, but finding out what those things are for your partner and then taking the time to be of service to them and go above and beyond what is expected of you, without any thought of reciprocation. Like, this isn't about getting something back. This is about changing their life. This is about creating an experience. Because, you know, those experiences we have when we're out in the bush on those big hunts and how we come back and we feel like we're different. You want to engineer something like that for her or him, whatever your thing is. Because the impact that it's going to have on your relationship is going to change anything. The quality of the communication we've had since we got back, the closeness, like, all of it. It's just, I don't remember feeling like this since we were newlyweds. And I don't even know if we felt like that then, but it was well worth it and a surprise. I did not expect that to come out of this vacation. All right, my buddy asked, do you think Kuyu and its users are a cult? Listen, man, I don't think Kuyu users are any more of a cult than Sitka users or XO backpack users or, you know, they might be a little more intense, or, you know, Kuyu is really expensive. So the people who buy Kuyu tend to have a little bit more money. So they tend to buy a little bit more of it. Like, but I think everybody is irrationally brand loyal to some degree. So I got nothing against Kuyu or the people who wear it. Future of deer hunting, hunting in general in BC, all tags being draws in the future, no over the counter. Personally, I'm a fan of more draws. I like more intentional wildlife management. I'd rather a good hunt every 3 to 4 years than a shit hunt every year. I think we're lazy in BC. I think the 6-point limit on elk and just having over the counter tags is ridiculous. I think there's a ton of ways that from a regulation and legislation perspective and from a wildlife management perspective, that there's so much low-hanging fruit that BC could do to make the hunting experience better here. Now, are they going to do it? I don't know. And I worry about all the native stuff because we live in such a PC diplomatic world that even like very rational arguments against some of these issues are seen as like racist and discriminatory. And it's like, what the fuck are you even talking about? Like, why can't we have a discussion? Like, it's just because somebody is a certain race, or like, I don't have anything against anybody, but like everything should be able to have an open, honest dialogue about it. But like, you try and say one thing against, you know, that caribou stuff up north, and it's like, oh, you're a racist. Everything belongs to them. And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. A, maybe it does. I don't know. But we need to have an open conversation, and we need to examine the issue from all separate angles before we come to any conclusion. We need to invite dialogue from different stakeholders. We need to have science. Like, this should be a long, difficult, community-based process, and it's just not right now. You know, somebody brings up some political angle and they just, from down on high, they execute these changes, and you're like, what are you even doing? So that's what worries me. It's not like we have the potential to have the best hunting on the planet, 100%, but do we have the, you know, backbone to do that? I don't know. Oh, I got a great one here. Best, fastest way to dry out your water bladder. They sit on the counter for weeks. I use a boot dryer, man. I think everybody should have a boot dryer. No matter how dry your boots get in the truck on the way home, there's always some mold in there. And when I come home and get a heated one, Canadian Tire, they're like $50. I blast them on high, usually a couple cycles. So like maybe 6 hours in general. And it kills everything in there. It takes any of the stench away. Also for winter hunts, you can dry your gloves. You can dry your toques. When I'm in a hotel, I take it with me. I dry my clothes on that thing. And yeah, you just open up the water bladder, stick it over the boot dryer, turn it on. That thing's cooked dry in like half an hour, no problem. When is initial ascent going to get put through the paces? I'm going to have to break eventually. Here's the thing with initial ascent. I tried to review it originally. I bought it. It was out of stock for 3 weeks. I had to continue with the review, the very first one I did. So I canceled my order, and then it came back in stock. They hit me up and I'm like, listen, I've already done this review. If you want me to review one, I'd love to. If you send me one, I will review it and send it back. I'm not looking for free gear. They were a bit weird. Everybody is allowed to say no. Don't get me wrong. But these guys, just the way they conversed, it was like, eh, it left a little bit of a weird taste in my mouth. And I was like, eh. So it's not, I'm not like falling all over myself to test their gear. I'll test any gear, but like sometimes you deal with a company and the way that they talk to you is just like, yeah, these aren't, you know, I'll give you a prime example. So I just had to buy a bear spray holster, and the two that immediately stuck out were the FHF and the marsupial. There were features of the FHF I liked better, but for me personally, I don't want to give FHF money. I will review their gear. I think Rick is a super good designer. I think they make super good gear. If you like FH gear, you're buying good gear. I have no problems with you. I think you should be very confident in your gear. I don't like the way Meat Eater markets. I don't like the churning group in general. I don't like their business model. So when possible, with my own money for my own products, I'm not going to support them because I believe we vote with our dollars these days. Now, Jim at Marsupial, fucking stud, man. He is such a good guy. He's making great shit. And even if his bear spray holder is maybe like 5 to 10% less than the FHF, he's getting my money because it still serves a purpose. I know it's going to be built like a tank. I know it's going to do what I want it to do. So I ordered my bear spray holder from Marsupial. So that being said, much like with the companies that I review and the products that I buy, who you are as a company and your values as a company. And I'm willing to say, like, I've got this wrong before. I've had interactions with people and, you know, got the wrong perception and was willing to admit I was wrong. So maybe I talk to them again. Maybe that's not the same way. Some companies are just not really open to people reviewing their stuff. And it's not because they don't like you. I think it's because there's a lot of people just reaching out for free shit. And, you know, they just think I'm another schmuck that wants a free backpack. And it's like, if you don't know me and you haven't watched the channel, I don't blame you. So I'm not going to hold it against you. They will get reviewed only because it's so requested. And you guys are why I make this content. So it'll happen. Probably not this calendar year. I'm just sick of backpacks, to be honest with you. I am going to do an EDC travel pack review, but it's more fun for me and it's a different style of backpack. So it means I can look at different things. By the way, if there's an EDC bag or a travel backpack that you want included in that review, send me a message. The hunt I'm most looking forward to and why. So this is the craziest year I've ever had on the books. And this is a really, really, really tough call because I'm looking forward to all of them. But I'm going to say archery mule deer in New Mexico. I love hunting the Southwest because it's so different from home. I love hunting here, but it's like there's weather challenges and topography challenges and vegetation challenges. Like BC is a hard, hard, hard place to hunt. And I'm not saying the Southwest isn't challenging. It is. But like a shitty day in the Southwest is way more enjoyable than a shitty day in BC. I can tell you that. And not only that, for me, it's more of an adventure. I'm going to a unit I've never been to before. I'm hunting in a way I've kind of never hunted before. I'm going to do that one solo. It's going to be my big solo hunt of the year. So yeah, that one for sure. Okay, headspace of accepting a smaller build for hunting now instead of bodybuilding. I have not achieved this yet. So I'm still pretty jacked and people are not jacked in Europe. And it was crazy. Like my wife and my daughter were like, this is getting out of hand everywhere we went. Because I was wearing a tank top most of the time because it was hot. Everybody was commenting on it. Like I couldn't walk around Rome without somebody saying something about me looking like a body. They all thought I looked like a bodyguard. And I don't know if that was like a translation thing, but dudes would be flexing at me and like, it was all fun and it was lighthearted, but like, yeah, it's a bit of an ego thing, man. I like walking around jacked and I gotta, yeah. So I don't know. I'm working on it, man. Slowly but surely I will slim down. Do I do any solo camping in between hunts? Historically, no. My time has been so precious that I save up all my away time for hunts because I'd rather spend my time hunting than doing anything else. But now that I'm transitioning over into making Mindful Hunter and Mindful Reviews more of a full-time part of my life, now that my daughter's older, now that I'm helping my wife with her business and she's more open to being gone more, I did more scouting this year than I have in the last 5 years. And moving forward, I will put overnight solo missions into that scouting routine. In fact, I already had one this year. I did an overnight. So in the past, I haven't, only because limited time. But in the future, I will do way more. Preferred broadhead. Iron Will S125. I've been using it for 3 years now, probably killed half a dozen animals, and I've had a pass through on every single animal that I've shot. And I have, you know, found quickly every single animal that I've shot with an Iron Will broadhead. So I love it. Different broadheads for different animals. This is a polarizing topic. I'm going to say, theoretically, I think it's a great idea. Especially if you're doing drastically different hunts. Like if you're going from an elk hunt to a tree stand whitetail hunt, is there an argument for different broadheads? Absolutely. Even like I've been thinking of getting a wide Iron Will for my bear hunts. Bears aren't, they're kind of soft, but the holes can close up on a bear really fast because the way, if they're turned when you shoot them and then they turn back, even after you get a pass through, that hide can close up the hole. Blood trails typically on bears are garbage. So even if I was going to stick with a fixed blade, I've been thinking about using a smaller blade for where I'm going to be shooting further and the animals are a little tougher, and then a wider blade for animals where I'm a little closer and where they're a little softer and where a bigger hole would be a better outcome. So I don't personally do it now only because, and I want to talk about, you know, an interesting principle here. I know Dan from Elk Shape and I like what he does, and he has this always be tinkering. And he thinks you should always be working on your setup. I respect Dan, and this isn't a slight in any way, but I disagree. I think in the real world with real people, get a setup that you trust and run it into the ground. I haven't significantly changed my arrow setup in 3 years. I bought my bow. I set it up a year ago. I threw it on the bow press to make sure it was tuned and in time this year. That was all I did. I didn't test any arrows. I didn't look at anything. Why? Because it works. This setup has put animals on the ground. If I hit an animal, it dies. There are a million ways I can spend my time. I can make content. I can go hunting. I can build arrow setups. Now for you, you got to answer the question, what activities are going to help you as a hunter most? And what do you like doing most? If you want to tinker with arrows all day, then go tinker with arrows all day. But I don't think you need to find time in your life to constantly be doing, I don't understand why you would want to do that. There's people like Dan who are extremely knowledgeable and are going to run through all that if there's some significant improvement in technology at some point. But like, let's be honest here, in the past 5 years, if not longer, nothing has come around that would warrant me changing my setup. I hand build all my arrows. I hand fletch all my arrows. I tested. Now, when I was building that setup, it took me months, you know, maybe a year to like go through all these different configurations and try a bunch of different stuff. I probably had 6 or 7 completely different setups during my introduction to archery in that first 2 to 3 years. I tried a lot of shit. Then when I landed on what I like and the system that worked for me, for all intents and purposes, I'm done. Now, Bill from Iron Will just did this big study with a university and he's come out with a new vein. I respect Bill a lot. He's a very, very smart guy. I may change my vein configuration because of what he unearthed in the study, but this is exactly what I mean. Until there is a fundamental shift in technology, I don't see the need in spending time tinkering because it's time I could be spent hunting. I'm a content creator. Now I could create content about tinkering because that's what Dan does. So, you know, but I'd rather record this podcast. I'd rather shoot a video on the food that I'm making. I woke up at, you know, 4 o'clock this morning so that I could go scouting today. I'd rather do that than tinker with arrows when I know, because here's the thing. I know the setup works. It's different if it's an area where you need to focus some new time. Like if you're not happy with your food setup, spend some time tinkering with your food setup. If you're not happy with your clothing setup, spend some time tinkering with your clothing setup. But tinkering just for tinkering's sake, in my opinion, is a waste of time and it erodes confidence. With archery in particular, I firmly believe confidence is everything. Confidence even outperforms or has a greater impact on the outcome than the technical proficiency of your setup. Like I think a dude who is very confident and shoots his setup all the time, who has it maybe not the best arrow setup and maybe not the fanciest bow. And then there's another guy who's like always tinkering, like doesn't quite know if it's, but he's got the fanciest bow and the most expensive arrow setup. I'll take that first guy who's confident in his setup all day, every day. When I bought a bow press, the quality of my shooting and the accuracy of my shooting probably went up like 30%. Why? Because I understood how my bow worked. I could tune it myself. I knew it was tuned. And the tuning maybe gave me 5 to 10%, but the other 20% improvement came from the fact that I was confident in my gear. And when you're always tinkering, you are going to go through periods where you lack confidence because you're going to be shooting with a new setup. And especially if you're going to do it in the off season. Because when you get close to game time, I stop. I don't ask questions. I look at what works and I stick with what works because I'm confident with it. So anyways, that's another reason why I haven't experimented with different setups because I like what I got and it kills. All right. I still got another 10 questions. I'm never going to get through those. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to answer those ones on Instagram on the drive to my scouting mission today. I want to thank everybody for the questions. These are hands down my favorite podcast episodes to do. I don't know if you noticed, but I try to do one a month. I try and do three regular podcast episodes, either a review, an interview, a deep dive into something, and then I have a Q&A. If you guys want more Q&As, let me know. They're like, technically speaking, from a preparation perspective, these are the easiest podcasts for me to do because I just hit record and read the questions and give the best answers I can come up with. So if you want more of these, please let me know. Another nudge, if you are interested in a community of like-minded people who nerd out on gear and who are supportive with other hunters, mindful-reviews.com. Participate in raffles, participate in reviews, buy a lifetime membership if you want, and you will be entered into monthly draws for kick-ass giveaways. And if you could help share this content, like, share, comment, subscribe, reviews on podcast platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify, giving me a rating out of 5 stars and writing a little blurb probably impacts my ranking and how many people get exposed to this the most. But if you could interact and engage with the content, I would greatly appreciate it. This podcast has grown exponentially since I started it. You know, when we hit November, that's going to be 3 years, which is crazy to think of. And I never thought it would play the role that it does in my life and for so many people. So I deeply appreciate you guys, but I do actively work on getting it out to more people. So if you can help me in that, I would greatly appreciate it. And as always, if you have any questions for me, if you think I screwed something up in this podcast or you want to add some further clarification, you can always leave a comment on YouTube, DM me on Instagram, mindful_hunter, or shoot me an email, j@mindfulhunter.com. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.